Blog Talk Radio.
Is there a doctor in the house?
Yes. 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 I think very deeply.
Dr. Brian Chan.
I think very deeply.
Dr. Brian Chan.
Speak on it, son.
Good evening. It's B. Chad, and I'm your host of Speak On It. Tonight, we'll be giving a tribute to Black History Month and African American leaders in this session. We'll first start off by informing you that we usually do our show in three different phases. I want to say thank you to my continued listeners. This is our third show, and hopefully we're working out some of these kinks as I'm taking some constructive insight from my listeners, as well as colleagues and co-workers involved, my team. I would like to give the telephone number out. It's 646-716-5871. Tonight we're just going to have a conversation, and we're going to be proud. We're going to be proud about the heritage, about the history. We're going to claim it as our own. I want to talk to you about some purposes, some impacts of Black History Month, as well as some of the leaders that have sacrificed a whole lot to put us currently in some of the situations that we're in now. So I want you to call in. It's going to be impossible to cover everyone, all events. I would love to know what you have going on locally to celebrate Black History Month. I would like to know if your job, your school, your community is doing nothing to celebrate Black History Month. And in that sense, I just want to share and have that conversation with our listeners. All right. So to begin, let's talk about Black History Month as our Black fact. Black History Month is an annual celebration of achievements by African Americans and a time for recognizing the central role of African Americans in United States history. Black History Month wasn't always a full month. It was Negro History Week, which was created by Brother Carter G. Woodson in 1926, and it was observed during the second week of the month of February. The second week of the month was chosen because it coincided with the birthdays of then President Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. Now, Carter G. Woodson, created this Negro History Week in 1926. Doing some quick math, this is the 90th year anniversary of Carter G. Woodson's Negro Week. So we really want to give pay homage to those 90 years and talk about the chronological order of how much change has occurred, including Negro History Week being celebrated and also advanced to becoming a full month. Carter Woodson founded the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History in 1915 to train African-American historians and to collect, preserve, and publish documents on Black life and Black people. Woodson never intended for Negro History Week or Black History Month to be about the first Blacks to do anything or everything and a parade of Black icons. It was created to bring attention and awareness to the Negro life. And in doing this, of course, we talk about the first, but it was more about the awareness and information of education that was being left out. That there was no one writing our story, his story. There was no one writing that story about the African-American, the Negro life at that time. So it was created out of a need to bring in education and awareness for everyone, not only just the Negro, but for everyone to understand and show value for the Negro life. Carter G. Woodson was born in Virginia And he, a proud member of Omega Psi Phi fraternity. He founded the Journal of Negro History in 1916, Associated Publishers in 1922, and the Negro Bulletin in 1937. Woodson spent his life working to educate all people about the vast contributions made by Black men and Black women throughout history. I really want us to hone in that I think one of the huge misconceptions about Black History Month is that it's only for Black people. Not so. We really want to challenge that mindset, that perspective about who gets to appreciate and value the history and the heritage and the tradition of Blacks, everyone. Black History Week was created because African Americans and their accomplishments were largely left out of the educational curricula of that time. Again, no one was really writing about these accolades, this Negro life, and Carter G. took it upon himself to bring much more national attention to the conversation and take an activist approach to challenge mainstream society to hear it and actually put something in print to implement what he thought should have been necessary in an educational environment. The emphasis was placed on encouraging the coordinated teaching of the history of African Americans in public schools. Just imagine what some of us would be now if we didn't have this Negro Week started and initiated in 1926. We often hear about having no culture, no identity, due to slavery and being here to the United States, unwillingly, but there's a great deal of information and knowledge that's out there that is used to connect us together to give us some of that history and foundation and self-awareness and security about the origination of where African Americans come from in the United States. And not just in slavery terms, in a much more positive light to debunk some of those stereotypes and myths that we know have been placed on the Negro. Most often, African Americans have been mentioned in very negative and demeaning ways. And Carter G. thought upon himself to eradicate, address some of the information that was being passed down that, you know, was stereotypical. Understanding the history of the United States, oftentimes when a minority group comes into the country historically and competes for economic viability, competes for jobs, competes for equality, equity. Oftentimes there have been negative stigmas and stereotypes attached to their identity to demean them in a certain way that alienates them from mainstream opportunity. We saw it done with Irish Catholic immigrants. We've seen it done with Mexican Latinos. But, you know, just to bring awareness about Black History Month and what Carter G. Woodson was thinking about creating Negro History Week, it was just that. It was just debunking some of these negative stereotypes that were just that, exactly stereotypes. And we know we're still challenged with this today. And we're going to talk about that in terms of Black History Week and what it means. Expansion of Black History Week to Black History Month was first proposed by the leaders of the Black United Students Organization at Kent State University in February of 1969. The first celebration of Black History Month on record took place at Kent State 1 year later in February 1970. Black History Month was actually expanded by United States government, actually by President Gerald Ford, in a bicentennial year of 1976. I noted that we were celebrating the 90th year of the Negro History Week created by Carter G. Woodson, but we also going to celebrate when February was designated, and I know you're saying the shortest month. Yeah, I get it. I hear you. But it occurred in 1976, so we do have that to be proud of in our 40th year we should celebrate. We should celebrate this opportunity to relish in the successes of some of the ancestors during this time. Just as Negro Week was met with some lukewarm responses, same thing for Black History Month has been met with resistance, I would say. Even to this day, 40 years later, we still often hear the questions, why do we need to designate a month for minority groups? Well, Blacks and African Americans are not the only ones, not the only minorities that have designated months or time or some type of frame, time frame period throughout the year. There's women, there's Latino, Hispanic. There's a number of different months, but it appears that this is always often a topic of discussion. And we're gonna discuss why Black History Month is important and why we should celebrate it. A little bit more in history. Black History Month gained cooperation from the Department of Education of the states of North Carolina, Delaware, West Virginia, cities of Baltimore and Washington, D.C. And the event was regarded by Woodson as one of the most fortunate steps ever taken by the association. So I'm happy to say and proud that Carter G. Woodson stepped out on faith and really initiated this conversation around awareness for Negro History Month that has developed to be very important to us all, and I don't to Americans as well as to the world, that we get to highlight some of our special people. Now, for the issues. Why? The issue is why are we still having to explain why I celebrate Black History Month? It's an honor to celebrate African-American historic leaders. It's an honor to celebrate the sacrifices and the challenges that were met face-to-face by those that were activists and wouldn't stand for inequality, wouldn't stand for injustice. Those that risked their families, their lives, their neighborhoods, their communities, in order for us to enjoy some of the many privileges that we have been afforded today. And it would not have been done. To all my young listeners that are unaware of a number of the challenges of being able to walk into any restaurant and spend your money as you choose, was not an option. There was a great deal of segregation, alienation, marginalization, a lot of Asians that did not benefit Blacks. And so it must be done in order to honor those and teach that history. Why study it? Why evaluate it? Why remember it? Why point it out? We need to teach our colleagues, our white colleagues, our Latino, our Asian, Hispanic colleagues about Black history, about the purpose of recognizing those that have sacrificed in order for lives to be made better. We also need to teach them with hopes that there's understanding and value that isn't often represented in the newspapers or by the media. We're consistently combating negative portrayals throughout the media as well as, you know, in some schools and education formats and everyday living. So it's important that we teach and remind them that there's more than one conversation to be discussed when the news is choosing to focus in on one type of part of history or one type of struggle African Americans are facing, and it often is around crime. So really want to make that clear. Also, we got to teach the youth. They have to have a much better understanding of what others have done in order to be able to benefit from it now. That's for a number of reasons. Getting them to believe and trust that they deserve the best and do not have to settle for the way things structurally are in this nation. That there have been worse times, and people have fought much more and a much greater sense of unity with less, with much less and more obstacles against them. And I often talk about what we now owe. We owe these conversations to our kids, to our youth, to our colleagues, to our wives, husbands, mothers, sisters, fathers, brothers. I think we need to have much more of this conversation. Excuse me, I know we do. We got to have much more of this conversation of history. Also, another reason why it challenges us for knowledge. We don't know everything. There's no, you know, it's impossible to remember everything that's been done. But we got to pick up some of these books and gain much more historical knowledge of the situations and events that have occurred that impact our lives today. Engage the community and awareness. Very important that we have some of these neighborhood sessions, neighborhood block parties, as we call them, you know, on the dirt road, just sharing information, chopping it up. I learned so much in an informal setting about my family history, my neighborhood history, history that wasn't taught to me in a public school system. Gave me a great foundation of what was expected of me in terms of my identity as an African-American man. A number of these stories were not printed, and they were not anyone that would be written about in a heroic fashion. But you and I both know there's so many neighborhood and community heroes in the Black community that have left, that have been able to leave legacies that deserve passed on. I often share some of my great stories of through the church and the baseball, Negro League baseball teams, that unity, those surrogate fathers that I had been able to get with them on Saturday and Sunday mornings, and the informal lessons I got about who am I and what do I stand for, and the name that I had to carry in the community, and how proud I was to be, you know, invited, accepted, but also high goals were set that, boy, you know who you are, you know what your daddy, your granddaddy, you know who your brothers are, you know, that type of history is so important, and I'm not sure that it's being highlighted and appreciated enough to be passed down to the young folks so they can have a sense of pride in who they are and where they're from and what names that they carry. And then it just tends to lean on to much more structural when you get into the formal settings of high school and education. As I often say, you know, we have many more Black heroes than King Rosa Parks. But most often, and I'm not going to, well, you know, being raised in the South, we didn't always hear about some of the Dred Scott stories and, you know, not as much about Malcolm X, but more about Dr. King, but, you know, scholars of W.B. Du Bois and, you know, Carter G. Woodson. And it just leans to Madam C.J. Walker is we didn't get an opportunity to dig deep into it often. Not sure if it was negligence or malicious. It was just, it wasn't offered. But having some of these church affiliates, association, and that baseball team, I was able to gather a great deal of knowledge that that got me on the, as I would call it, a hungry quest. So it's very important that we share with these young brothers and sisters and challenge them to be accountable. One thing I'm so proud of, I've seen men of Omega Psi Phi fraternity, which I am a member, have a Black Heritage competition for middle school and high school kids, and where they have a certain amount of time to remember Black History Month facts, and they have to come in with no notes, and they have to regurgitate and answer and remember years and legislation and events. And I think that just leads to so much accountability and foundation for identity. It's such a positive thing. Black history, It's the world's history. There's a lot of pain from 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, 21st century that the United States has documented and been a part of in landing the struggle and sacrifices of the African American experience. And I think that it should not just be 1 month, should not just be 28 days. It should not be regulated only for parents and brothers and sisters to do it. It should be in our school systems. It should be through the media. It shouldn't be just in the February. It should be every day. There's 365 days in a year, and I know that there's exponentially more African Americans that have a great lesson, a great mission, great works that we could discuss on a daily basis, and not have to wait to just February. This is United States history, and Black History Month gives us a chance to focus on it. But it's the world's history, and we should challenge ourselves to make sure that we do our part each and every day to deliver great historical facts, to compete with the negative stereotypes that we know one faces when he or she walks out of the door. And I think it would go a long way with combating diversity issues, cultural competency issues, self-identity, self-reflection. I think empowerment is the word that I would like to use and cling on to, empowerment for us all. Most often we often hear terms of racism, sexism, genderism, all type of ism being thrown around. And most often that word, the ism, has a strong correlation to ignorance. And I feel in terms of just this short conversation is that more information and education to be given, I believe, is the beginning of creating a better society. So we're going to elevate that. We're going to elevate that through information and education. I'm waiting on some callers to call in. That is the brief introduction of the Black History facts, as well as some of the issues we're going to talk about. Call in at 646-716-5871 and share some of your experiences about your learning of Black History Month and what's important and whether or not you celebrate it and how you celebrate. All right. Until we get some callers, I'm going to continue with the show. I'm going to discuss some instances in United States history that I deem important that may not get as much attention as some of the others of recognition. University of Alabama's first Black student suspended. Arthur and Lucy was born on October 5th, 1929 in Shiloh, Alabama. She studied English and worked as a teacher before enrolling at the all-white University of Alabama. Polly Ann Myers, friend of hers, suggested that she and Arthurine enroll at the school for their graduate program. They wanted to get master's degrees. They were accepted in 1952 with standard procedures commenced until university officials realized that they were both African American. So on paper, these two females had met all the educational requirements, all the criteria to gain entry into the graduate program. But once their racial identity was revealed, that admittance was immediately taken away. On arrival to the admissions office, they were barred from enrolling. With attorneys Arthur Shores and, of course, historically, Thurgood Marshall, they petitioned for university admittance. Lucy became an English teacher. During this time, she became an English teacher at Mississippi High School. It wasn't until 2 years later, until the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education ruling declaring segregation illegal in public schools, that she would once again confront the University of Alabama's racial policies. In the summer of 1955, a federal judge ruled that the school had to admit the two women. The institution, University of Alabama, denied Polly Ann Myers admission on the grounds that she had become pregnant out of wedlock. She did not have a husband. Another way to alienate. Arthurin faced threats from a large, out-of-control mob, but decided to attend school alone. What heart? 1950s. February 3rd, 1956. Arthurin Lucy registered and attended her first classes at the University of Alabama. What courage. She wasn't allowed to live on campus. There were protests by thousands of students and community members that occurred each and every day. Only a few days later, after beginning her pursuits to gain a master's degree, she was suspended on February 6, 1956, on the grounds of citing safety concerns. Her attorneys challenged the suspension, but despite a court order, university trustees voted to expel her. Lucy has been recognized for her trailblazing efforts in desegregating the University of Alabama. And in 1988, 32 years later, the school lifted its expulsion. Lucy opted to receive her master's in education, attending the school at the same time as her daughter, and graduating in 1992. Since then, a scholarship has been established in her name and in her honor of standing up in the face of segregation in educational environments. What social justice, what power, what strength that Lucy must possess at that time. Now, as we see University of Alabama, and I can give it through a lens of sports, I do not think that they face the same situation now with letting some African-Americans in their schools. Trailblazer she was for many of us that don't even realize what she advocated for and advocated against. Going to bring this one a little closer home. The protest in Orangeburg, South Carolina, better known as the Orangeburg Massacre. February 8, 1968. Three South Carolina State students were killed and 27 were injured during the fourth night of segregation protests in Orangeburg, South Carolina. This occurred at All-Star Bowling Lane, which was the only bowling alley in Orangeburg, which played a pivotal role in the Orangeburg Massacre. Segregated bowling alley was a rarity in Orangeburg because most public spaces in the city at that time were integrated. Since the 1964 Civil Rights Act, local black leaders and members of the white business community had tried to persuade the All-Star Bowling Lane to reconcile and integrate its business. Efforts, legal efforts, more efforts, and simultaneously appeals to United States Justice Department failed to get the bowling alley to integrate. African Americans argued that since All-Star had a snack bar, it was certainly covered under the Federal Act for Integration. On February 6, a group of black students from South Carolina State and Claflin University came to the bowling alley and refused to leave. The next night, another group returned, and 15 of those black males and female students were arrested. February 8th, students started a bonfire on the state's campus to protest the arrest. Authorities moved in, put out the fire, and one officer was injured during the melee by a piece of railing that was thrown at him. The crowd facing the officers intensified. The crowd grew, more people came, and a shooting began because a highway patrolman fired his gun in the air a few times. This melee led to three students being killed, Henry Smith, Samuel Hammond, and a local high school student, then 17-year-old Delano Middleton. 9 highway patrolmen faced federal charges in connection with the shootings. All 9 were acquitted. The Orangeburg Massacre was the most violent incident recorded in the South Carolina civil rights history. In 2001, South Carolina State had a ceremony honoring the victims of the shooting. Standing up against injustices, folks. Black History Month. Social justice. They're willing to put their lives on the line to make it better for those of us here today. 646-716-5871. Speak on it. Give me a call. Let me know how you celebrate Black History Month. Let me know how much you're instilling in your kids, in your youth, the conversation of Black achievement in their minds. The Little Rock Nine. 9 Black students enrolled at a formerly all-white Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas in September 1957. Students, Minnie Jean Brown, Elizabeth Eckford, Ernest Green, Thelma Mothershed, Melba Patillo, Gloria Ray, Terrence Roberts, Jefferson Thomas, and Carlotta Walls. On May 17, 1954, the United States Supreme Court ruled that segregation in public schools was unconstitutional, Brown v. Board. Until the court's decision, many states across the nation had mandatory segregation laws requiring African-American and Caucasian children to attend separate schools. Resistance to the ruling was so widespread that the court issued a second decision in 1955 known as Brown the Second, ordering school districts to integrate with quote unquote with all deliberate speed. To note, it is stated in a number of the research documents that I've looked at is that Brown v. Board wasn't really implemented on the federal level, state and local level, until 1964, which is about 10 years after it was actually passed, where we saw integration in school districts. I know some of us, again, just piggybacking off Brown v. Board, integration and segregation has been a topic of conversation around Black history. And to my callers, I would like to know your opinion. What do you think? Do you think the integration and segregation hurt us? Do you think we should have remained segregated and taught our own babies? Or do you think integrating has helped us achieve what we sought out in challenging the segregation? Because one often says is, often discusses is, Blacks were fighting for the same resources as the whites during this time. It was about dilapidated school buildings. It was about one-room schoolrooms that my mother used to tell me about, where one teacher would teach everyone that was in the first grade all the way up to the 12th grade. Can you imagine what type of lesson plan that was? And the children came out much more educated, some say, than compared to post-integration. So I'm curious to hear what my listeners have to say in reference to Black History Month, whether or not integration or segregation has either helped or hurt us. Okay. On September 4th, 1957, the first day of classes at Central High, Governor Orville Faubus of Arkansas called in the State National Guard to bar the Black students' entry into the school, claiming it was for their own protection. For their own protection, again, another sighting of safety concerns to protect you on why we shouldn't integrate. Government assistance during this time, 50s and the early 60s. Later in the month, President Eisenhower sent troops to escort the Little Rock Nine into the school. Fight fire with fire. The nine students started their first full day of classes on September 25, 1957. Some students report that they had positive experiences. Some report not so much. According to the New York Times, some of the students experienced routine harassment and even violence throughout the rest of the year, which we could expect, right? I mean, whenever there's a change occurring, most often the majority isn't ready for it. And, you know, we often combat things we don't understand with violence, most often. White students burned an African-American effigy in a vacant lot across from the school. Melba Patillo was kicked, beaten, and had acid thrown in her face. Gloria Ray was pushed down a flight of stairs. Little Rock Nine were barred from participating in extracurricular activities. No sports, no clubs, no organizations, just come to school and go home. Minnie Jean Brown was expelled from Central High in February 1958 for retaliating against the attack. Gloria Ray's mother was fired from a job with the state of Arkansas when she refused to remove her daughter from the school. 101st Airborne and the National Guard remained at Central High for the duration of the year. They kept the National Guard, armed National Guard, on site at the high school. May 25, 1958, Ernest Green, the only senior among the Little Rock Nine, became the first African-American graduate of Central High. September 1958, 1 year after Central High was integrated, Governor Faubus closed Little Rock's high schools for the entire year, pending a public vote for African-American attendance. Little Rock citizens voted 19,470 to 7,561 against integration, and the schools remained closed. Other than Green, the rest of the Little Rock Nine completed their high school careers via correspondence or at other high schools across the country. Ironically, Little Rock High Schools reopened in August 1959. They closed them down just so they wouldn't have to integrate. Eckford joined the Army and later earned her general education equivalency diploma. Green served as Assistant Secretary of the Federal Department of Labor under President Jimmy Carter. Brown worked as Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Workforce Diversity in the Department of the Interior under President Bill Clinton. Patillo worked as a reporter for NBC. The group has been widely recognized for their significant role in civil rights history. In 1999, President Clinton awarded each member of the group the Congressional Gold Medal. The nine also received personal invitations to attend President Barack Obama's inauguration. Social justice at its best. They had no idea that they would be pioneers. They only wanted an education. They only wanted to fight against injustice and inequality. These conversations have to be included in our tribute to Black History Month, has to be included in the conversations every day to the youth to value getting up every day, regardless of the weather, regardless of sometimes what's going on in the home, regardless of whether or not the teachers are liking us, regardless of whether or not the kids are picking on us and making fun, regardless if we hate recess, regardless if we hate the lunch line, we still got to go. We got to go to educate ourselves and put ourselves in positions to have a successful life. But we also got to go for those that's coming up behind us. Imagine if Gloria Ray would have stopped. Imagine if Melba would have stopped. What would have happened? What would we have to celebrate in the month of February? What would we have to talk about but who sacrificed their comfortableness to put us in a better position to get a quality education? Elbert Williams, first known member of the NAACP to be murdered for his civil rights activities. Born on October 15, 1908, in rural Haywood County, Tennessee. Tragically, At the age of 32, he was murdered in 1940. The efforts and simultaneous appeals to the United States Justice Department has failed ongoing to investigate who was at the hands of such a tragic death. In 1939, he and his wife became charter members of Brownsville NAACP branch. On May 6, 1940, five members of Brownsville NAACP branch unsuccessfully attempted to register to vote. No African American had been allowed to register to vote in Haywood County during the 20th century. Threats began on the following day. June 6, 1940, will be registrant Elisha Davis abducted from her home by white mob led by Brownsville policemen Tip Hunter and Charles Reed. Yes, a white mob led by police officers. They took him to the nearby Hatchie River swamp, surrounded him, and threatened him with death unless he named the member of the Brownsville NAACP. After naming some of them, he was forced to leave the county under the threat of death if he ever returned. After hearing about this incident, many other families fled Haywood County, Tennessee as well. The Williams family, they didn't leave. On June 20, 1940, uniformed policemen Hunter and Reed and a third man named Ed Lee, who was the manager of Coca-Cola Company, took Elbert Williams from his home, jailed him, and questioned him about an NAACP meeting he was suspected of planning. Hunter claimed that he released Williams, who never returned home and was never seen alive again. 3 days later, Williams' corpse was found in the nearby Hatchie River. Annie Williams identified her husband's body and saw two bullet-like holes in his chest. Haywood County Coroner Bill Cox ordered no medical examination and held his inquest on the riverbank that same morning. Coroner determined the cause of William's death as unknown. Coroner ordered immediate burial, and Williams was buried the same day in an unmarked grave. Local grand jury found that William's death was caused by, quote, foul violence at the hands of parties unknown. The Department of Justice ordered the United States Attorney in Memphis to present the case to a federal grand jury, but then mysteriously reversed its decision and closed the case, citing insufficient evidence. Thurgood Marshall, an attorney, was livid but unable to get the case reopened. The Elbert Williams Memorial Committee was formed in 2014 to bring attention to the long dormant murder case. Early in 2015, the Tennessee Historical Commission granted the committee's application for an official historical marker honoring Williams. In June 2015, the 75th anniversary of Williams' death, a memorial service and the dedication of the historical marker were held in Brownsville, Tennessee. The Department of Justice has under consideration requested to reopen this investigation into Williams' death. Elbert Williams' death, I think, signifies for me a number of stories and childhood information sessions, I would say, that was given to me about black men who stood up against injustice that were never seen again. My great-grandfather is one of them, whom I was always told he went fishing with three white men and never came home again. There's a number of scholars and researchers out there talking about politicized racial injustice and challenging the United States government to go back and revisit some of these cases. We've seen it with Emmett Till. I believe we've seen it in movies like Mississippi Burning, where African-American lives were not as valued as others, in particular as whites. And it had no value in our criminal court system. And oftentimes, black men and women were killed without due process being conducted, and no one ever been made accountable. But these social justice advocates, their sacrifice in fighting for justice has now allowed us in the last 60 years to bring attention to a great deal of these injustices. And Department of Justice, they are being asked, and sometimes hands are politically being forced to revisit some of these cases and hold someone accountable. Doesn't matter if they are 70 and 60, 80 and 90 years old, or they've even left here. These families deserve to know that the United States criminal court system wants to advocate on behalf of those lives that were once deemed not as important as others. So it's important to educate our colleagues, our friends, our coworkers, our family members about these injustices to shine light that, hey, situations may appear to be like this now, but it hasn't always been a sense of equity. Life hasn't always had the same value. And we got to know about the Herbert Williams and the Emmett Teals that have passed on, but due process wasn't a part of the conversation, and understand how that, you know, can get passed down in certain communities to have this disgruntled approach between law enforcement or court systems or politics and policies and legislation. It's awareness. And that's what Carter G. Woodson started this for in 1926, was about awareness. All right. Still got some time, 646-716-5871. Give me a call and let me know. Black children arrested and assaulted while protesting segregation in Birmingham, Alabama. May 2nd, 1963, more than 700 black children protesting racial segregation in Birmingham, Alabama, were arrested, blasted with fire hoses, clubbed by the police, and attacked by police dogs. And yes, I did say more than 700. As part of the Children's Crusade launched by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to revive the Birmingham anti-segregation campaign, more than 1,000 African-American children were trained in nonviolent tactics, walked out of their classes, and assembled at the 16th Street Baptist Church to march to downtown Birmingham. Hundreds were arrested and transported to jail in school buses and paddy wagons, but the children refused to relent. May 3rd, 1963, hundreds more children began to march. Commissioner of Public Safety, then Eugene, quote-unquote Bull Connor, directed local policemen and firemen to attack the children with high-pressure fire hoses, batons, and police dogs. Images of children being brutally assaulted by police dogs. Images of children being brutally assaulted by police officers appeared on local and national television, newspapers, throughout the entire nation, which provoked a global outrage. Everyone was unhappy about how these children were being treated. United States Department of Justice, again, intervened. Campaign to desegregate Birmingham ended on May 20, 1963 with an agreement that would halt demonstrations in exchange for city officials releasing in-prison protesters and desegregating the city's downtown stores. People were willing to go to jail, folks, for what was right. People were willing to risk their lives, folks, for what was right. The following evening, disgruntled proponents of segregation responded to the agreement with the series of local bombings. In the wake of the Children's Crusade, the Birmingham Board of Education announced that all children who participated in the march would be suspended or expelled from school, punished either way, with a voice or no voice, silenced. The local federal district court upheld the ruling, but the United States Courts of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit reversed the decision. Friendship none. Just continuing with this conversation of children protesting and students. This also occurred in South Carolina, in Rock Hill, South Carolina, to be exact. It's actually known as Friendship Nine Jail Nobel of 1961. And that was a sit-in at McCrory's lunch counter where African Americans were not allowed to be served. So nine students from Rock Hill Friendship Junior College went in and sat down and demanded that they be served like the white patrons. It didn't happen. They were arrested. But they took a different approach than most did during the civil rights era. They elected to stay in jail and, in a sense, allow the county to spend their resources on them to hurt them financially in lieu of the civil rights activists putting up funds to gain their release. In other words, the electricity, the water, the food that they had to provide them with was a way to cripple the system financially. The more resources you have to spend on me and I stay in jail, then the crippling of your approach, we can do it internally from a financial component. This was a rare and different approach during these times that these nine were taking upon themselves. And it was pretty heroic to leave college class one day to enter into a jail cell to fight against an injustice. Just really want to highlight how huge Black History Month is in having these conversations, these education forums, these information sessions, and teaching our youth. I am proud to say that their attorney then, who is Esquire Ernest A. Finney, was eventually elected as the first African-American Chief Justice to the South Carolina Supreme Court. So he was doing this work for a very long time, and very proud. And also proud to say that another brother is the second Supreme Court Justice, not chief yet, but will be, fraternity brother of mine in South Carolina, whom we're proud of, very proud of. Okay, we'll give one more before we get to our Black Achievement shout out. Murder of Jimmie Lee Jackson, February 18, 1965. Civil rights activists gathered in Marion, Alabama for a night march held to protest the arrest of James Orange, a field secretary for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. The protesters were met by state troopers and violence ensued. Town street lights were turned off. Under the cover of darkness, police and state troopers attacked the protesters with clubs, sending them fleeing in different directions. During the attack, Jimmie Lee Jackson was shot twice in the abdomen and died 8 days later. He was sent to a local hospital, then a hospital in Selma. He died at the age of 26. Jimmie was born in Alabama on December 16, 1938. He became part of the civil rights movement as a very young man. His death inspired a voting rights march. Violence at that protest, known as quote-unquote Bloody Sunday, made more Americans favor civil rights and made it possible to pass the 1965 Voting Rights Act. After fighting the Vietnam War and spending time in Indiana, he returned to his hometown. Jackson's shooting was condemned by leaders of the civil rights movement, such as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who had visited Jackson in the hospital, also John Lewis and James Bevel. On March 3rd, King spoke at Jackson's funeral, where he said that Jackson had been, quote, murdered by the brutality of every sheriff who practiced lawlessness in the name of law, end quote. Jackson's death also inspired civil rights leaders to hold the Selma to Montgomery March on March 7, 1965. James Fowler, the state trooper who confessed to killing Jackson, did not face any immediate repercussions following the fatal shooting. It wasn't until 2007, 42 years after Jackson's death, that Fowler was arrested and charged with first and second degree murder. Fowler initially maintained that he had acted to defend himself, but eventually accepted a plea bargain for misdemeanor manslaughter. He received a 6-month jail sentence, but served only 5 months and was released in July of 2011 because of health problems. In 2011, the FBI began investigating Fowler's role in the 1966 death of Nathan Johnson, another black man who Fowler had fatally shot after he stopped Johnson for suspension of drunk driving. Fowler died of pancreatic cancer on July 5th, 2015 at 81. Again, speaking to the courage to stand up, even risking life, and also the failure of the courts to respond. Okay, now, our Black Achievement, this session goes out to President Barack Obama, the first black president in history. Born in Hawaii on August 4th, 1961, father's from Kenya and his mother's from Kansas, raised with help from his grandfather who served in the Army. He was raised with help from his grandmother who worked on her way up from the secretary pool to middle management at a local bank. President Obama worked his way through college, Occidental College in Los Angeles, California, to Columbia University in New York with the help of scholarships and student loans. He moved to Chicago after college where he worked with a group of churches to help rebuild communities devastated by the closure of local steel plants. He attended law school at Harvard Law in 1988, where he became the first African-American president of the Harvard Law Review Journal. Graduated magna cum laude from Harvard in 1991. Upon graduation, he returned to Chicago to help lead a voter registration drive, teach constitutional law at the University of Chicago between 1992 and 2004, and remain active in his community. He helped organize voter registration drives during then President Bill Clinton's 1992 presidential campaign. Called this time of his life, quote, the best education I ever had, better than anything I got at Harvard Law School, end quote. Credited this experience as crucial to finding his identity, something that shaped his path to the White House. He was a community organizer, civil rights lawyer, and teacher before pursuing a political career. He published an autobiography in 1995, Dreams from My Father, A Story of Race and Inheritance, which has now been printed in more than 25 different languages. Years of public service based around his unwavering belief in the ability to unite people around a politic. He was elected to Illinois State Senate in 1996. He passed the first major ethics reform in 25 years, cut taxes for working families, and expanded health care for children and their parents in the Illinois State Senate. He was elected to United States Senate in 2004. As a U.S. Senator, he reached across the aisle to pass groundbreaking library reform, lock up the world's most dangerous weapons, and bring transparency to government by putting federal spending on it. He was elected as the 44th President of the United States on November 4th, 2008. He was sworn in on January 20th, 2009. First sitting president to stand up for marriage equality and is fighting for equal pay and a woman's right to make her own health decisions. He believes that an economy that's built to last starts by growing and strengthening the middle class. Shouts out, President Obama. We appreciate everything that you stand for. Hey, folks. Tribute to Black History Month is now coming to an end. I hope that you've gained some insight and information. Please spread the word. Don't wait until Black History Month. Tune in 2 weeks to speak on it, February 29th, where we'll be discussing Black politics. And thank you. I appreciate your listeners. Have a good one. Speak on it.